It's a resource that a lot of us take for granted, but for hundreds of millions of people across the world, access to clean water is becoming increasingly difficult, and in some cases, there's no access at all.
That has our next guest concerned. She points out that water is a finite resource. She says if we want to live in a water-secure future, we need to start making some changes now.
Joining us is Maud Barlow. She's the head of the Council of Canadians and the founder of the Blue Planet Project. Her new book is called Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. She's also chair of Food and Water Watch. Maud, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So in 2010, the United Nations General Assembly voted to recognize water as a basic human right. How important would you say that decision was?
Well, it was something I worked on for close to 20 years, so I'm biased. I think it was really important. It didn't mean that the next day that we all woke up in the world and everything was fine, but it did mean that the people of the world, represented by their governments, made a determination that it is not okay for somebody to die or somebody to watch their child die of waterborne disease or lack of access to water in a world where there's so much access, so much money, and really all it comes down to is readjusting, access. So it was a very, very hard fight. Everybody thinks, well, what a motherhood. Of course water is a human right, but you'd be surprised the fight we had. We had a number of countries against it, including my own, Canada, and yours at the time, although the United States has changed its position, is now in favor. But a lot of the big water companies, the World Bank was opposed because it was promoting privatization of water in the global south and so on. So it was quite the battle, and it was a very, very big and important step forward in the fight for water justice.
Well, the politics of water has changed over the years. In fact, just the fact that we have a phrase, politics of water, is something that's new. I think a lot of people take water for granted. Can you talk about why today a declaration like that, declaring water a basic human right, is necessary at all?
Well, you're right. The concept of the politics of water is fairly new because we all grew up believing what we learned in grade six, which is that there's no end to water. It goes around in a hydrologic cycle and it can't go anywhere. Maybe you can pollute it, but certainly it's not going to leave the planet.
Right, the water cycle. I can see the little arrows pointing up into the sky and back down.
We all learned it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's wrong, Veronica. Actually, what we're doing is that we are polluting, displacing, and most importantly, removing water where we can get at it, in groundwater and lakes and rivers and so on. We're damming them to death. We're pumping that groundwater up mercilessly. I mean, the Ogallala Aquifer in your country will be gone, says your Department of Agriculture, in our lifetime. I mean, we are literally taking it from where we can access it to where we can no longer access it, or putting it in the global food trade, huge amount of water and what's called virtual water in commodities and so on. And so where the water is suddenly going is to the places where people have money and power to access it. And the places that people are finding that they don't have water access are the areas of the world that are more poor. Now, we think about it in terms of somewhere like India or, you know, Bolivia, you know, the global south and so on. But it's really important that people get their heads around that as water becomes more scarce and it's becoming more expensive, and there's more of a political fight about it. This is also happening in the global north. In Detroit, which, as you know, has recently declared bankruptcy, there are close to 90,000 people who've had their water cut off, period. I mean, they may as well be living in a community in the global south. They have to take their buckets and their however they carry their water and go out to public parks or public community centers, fill up the water and bring it home. They've cut off a lot of people in Europe over the recent austerity measures where they're raising the price of water or privatizing it. So we're on a planet, and it's important for people to know, and it's almost impossible if you live near the Great Lakes to really get this because, you know, looking out at those beautiful Great Lakes, you can't imagine they could ever be gone. But we are a planet that is going through our water faster than it can be replenished.
And I want to talk about the privatization of water and also the Great Lakes. But first, you know, you write that the biggest challenge to clean, accessible water is corporate control of water. Can you give us some examples of how that has already been playing out or could be playing out in the years to come?
Well, the big, powerful corporations learn before most people did that whoever controls water in the future will be both powerful and wealthy. So you have privatization of municipal water services when municipalities are cash-strapped and need easy money, but then, of course, you're paying for it for generations because it's all based on profit. There's a massive bottled water industry in the world where companies like Nestle and Coca-Cola are taking local water sources, bottling them, shipping them around the world. There's water trading, which is happening in places like Texas and California, where you actually trade the actual water. T. Boone Pickens, your billionaire energy guy, is hoarding and trading Ogallala water. So it happens in a lot of ways that where we transfer water from being kind of a public trust or a public service, or this notion that it belongs to all of us, which doesn't mean, by the way, it should be a free-for-all. I'm not saying that. But that notion that we collectively have to take care of it and we all have to have equitable access to moving it to a place where it is for the wealthy. It is a proprietary resource. And more we're finding that the fights are around putting water on sale in the open market like oil and gas. And that's going to be the fight of the future.
You wrote about, I think it was Bolivia, isn't it, where the rights to rainwater were sold at one point.
They not only came in and privatized water. This is at the behest of the World Bank. It was Bechtel. And they tripled the price of water, but they said to the people, we own the water coming out of the sky, and any water you capture in buckets or cisterns or whatever, which is traditional in most countries, we own, you have to pay for it. They had inspectors going around saying you have to pay for it. You can imagine there was a revolution, literally an armed revolution, and the company was forced to leave. But I mean, and now that's an extreme, but I think in a world where the demand is going straight up and the supply is going straight down, you're going to see more of that kind of struggle in the future than less.
Well, so in the book, you lay out four principles for a water-secure future. I want to start with the first one, water as a human right. And we talked about how that had just been declared recently by the United Nations General Assembly. But how does that play out on the ground? How do we assure that water is a human right for people?
Well, in some countries, it's quite obvious where you have, the majority of the population not having access to sanitation or clean water. Then you have to really retool the way you spend money, and the money coming from groups like the World Bank has to go to providing accessible public health care or water care rather than allowing it to go to the private companies. In a country like Canada or the United States, where most people have access to clean water, it's more two issues. One is American Native or Canadian First Nations communities, we find there's a high incidence of lack of clean water, access to clean water. But we're finding more and more that it's when the water gets destroyed by a practice. Maybe it's fracking the local energy supply, or maybe it's a coal top mountain coal mining, or other areas that or other ways that we abuse water, and then the local people have no right or access to clean water. It might be in California, where the best water goes by in canals to the wealthy farmers of Southern California, and the local people have to bring in bottled water because they can't afford the clean water that's going by them. So it's going to take different forms in different parts of the world, but it all has the same principle that we should not allow water to go to be taken by those with money while those without have to go without water.
Now, you mentioned water used in fracking. That's something we in Wisconsin are interested in. We have a big frack sand mining operation, or at least interest here in Wisconsin. Tell us about how water is used in fracking.
Well, interesting. I'm just writing a new report on the Great Lakes and the threat of extreme energy, including fracking and this tar sands energy coming from Canada, which was involved in this recent decision around Wisconsin and Superior, Wisconsin. Fracking is exploding in the United States, as you know. Fracking has meant that the United States has gone from seeing itself as, having to continue to be an importer of energy to eventually becoming an exporter. The United States has recently become the major gas producer in the world, and that's because of fracking. But what it does, fracking uses an enormous amount of water. It destroys an enormous amount of water through the chemical compound that allows the process to happen. And generally, they leave the water in the ground, in underground storage, which then, of course, leaks into the local groundwater. Recently, this is very distressing to know, the Coast Guard in the United States has said that it's going to permit fracked wastewater to be transported on large barges on America's rivers and lakes, which is an accident waiting to happen because the chemicals that used in the fracking process are volatile. That, whenever you hear about these train wrecks involving fracked oil from the back in fields in North Dakota, it's because of xylene and toluene and these kinds of compounds that explode on impact that we're hearing about these terrible disasters. So it's something we need to really talk about, and those of us who live near or on the Great Lakes really need to say no to more fracking around the Great Lakes, because I think it's going to put our lakes in great danger.
We're talking with Maude Barlow right now about the future of Earth's water, and we want to hear from you. What do you think should be done to protect the world's water and to make it accessible? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Maude Barlow about the future of the world's water, and you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, and you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Maude, you may have heard it there on our newscast. There's a story in the news today that I wanted to get your take on. In West Virginia, we heard about a chemical leak that has contaminated the water supply for about 100,000 residents. Wondering what your reaction is to that and what should be the takeaway.
Yes, that's had international news, as a matter of fact. Well, what I call for in the book is that we need a new water ethic, and we need to place the protection of water at the center of everything we do. We cannot be having these kind of accidents and then saying, well, then let's go back to the company and tell them not to let it happen again. We have to have laws that protect water and watersheds. We only have a tiny, tiny, small amount of fresh, finite, clean water on our planet. And if you see a photograph of the Earth to size with all the water gone, this is a great big brown ball, and then beside it's a little blue ball, but that includes all the ocean and ground, or soil water. Beside it is a tiny little pinprick of blue. That's all the fresh water that we have on Earth. And if we had a different mindset and didn't see water as a resource to make our lives more convenient, you know, for profit, to move it around, dump whatever we want in it, think about it after the fact. If we had a different mindset that said, no, everything we do, from our agricultural policy to our energy policy to our environmental regulations, have to say, protect that water, protect those watersheds. There isn't another set of these watersheds around the world. I mean, we have to protect what we have. And I hope that this will act as a wake-up call for the people, because it's horrible when this happens and you try to fix it up after the fact. And by the way, if you think it's going to cost money to protect it before these accidents happen, think about the money it costs after these accidents happen.
I want to ask you one more question, and then I want to go to our phone lines because we have a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. Earlier, you talked about the dangers of corporate control of water and how it needs to be accessible to everyone. And for a long time, people have been predicting water wars. That's not necessarily something that's new. We've been hearing that in the past decade. Is there a case to be made that if there is privatization of water, that at least there is an organized institution that is, you know, an entity that can be dealt with at a governmental level, an institutional level, rather than sort of just a free-for-all over water?
No, the greater danger is that privatization leads to that confrontation, because it really then becomes the profit motive versus the public good. If you have proper public trust law, which is what we need, I mean, you have it better entrenched in your country than many, and certainly around the Great Lakes, there's public trust law, but it isn't understood and it isn't enforced properly. If you have public trust law, you're basically saying, look, this water, the water of the Great Lakes, for instance, belongs to the people who live on and depend on the Great Lakes. It belongs to all of us collectively. And nobody has the right to come along and destroy it or take it for private profit. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a place for water in private industry? Of course there is, but those industries would have to convince the owners of the water, that is the public trust, that they're going to take care of it and that they're not going to overuse it or abuse it, and they're going to put it back as clean as is humanly possible, you know, if they've been using it and returning it. And then that becomes their responsibility to convince us, the public, that they're going to take care of it. That's a very different concept than allowing the market to take it and then having a deregulated environment, which is, of course, what the private sector always goes for, so that then they can do what they want with that water or with the water that they've bought. So I think, you know, I'm not against the private sector. We need private sector in the world. That's not my point. But there are certain things that should be outside the marketplace. And when you have a declining water source in the world and a growing demand, you have to have very specific rules to make sure that it's protected as a public trust, as a public service, and as mm-hmm. a human right. And by the way, when I say human right, I don't mean you have the right to use whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. There's no human right to water for golf courses or swimming pools. We're not talking about that kind of free-for-all.
Let's go to our phones now. We have Andrew with us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Doing okay. What do you think about water?
What do I think about water? So my comment, in some ways, it's sort of been addressed in the ensuing, you know, conversation or dialogue here, but in terms of private property rights versus more of a public doctrine approach. But I guess my overall comment was just kind of exploring that theme a little bit more. You know, if I'm certainly sympathetic to the notion that water's, should be thought to be a basic human right, just like I feel that way about housing. It's kind of a dyed-in-the-wool liberal, grew up in Madison. At the same time, I've, you know, been around long enough to see plenty of situations where, you know, not just here in this country, but around the world, where you don't put a value on something like water, that the resource can be abused and, you know, poorly allocated, just like it can be when it's under total, you know, corporate private control. So what are some other ways, you know, we can approach pricing and allocation of water that would be more equitable, in your opinion? And ultimately, if we do decide it's, you know, to really treat it like we would, you know, recreational access to recreational fishing waters in Wisconsin or something, how do we ultimately decide, you know, who actually decides, you know, whether that drop goes to a farmer or an endangered, you know, toad or such and such community down the, right, you know, in the area?
All right. Good questions. Thank you, Andrew.
Well, Andrew, those are fabulous questions, and I don't for a minute say that because water should not be privately controlled that there should be no rules. I'm not saying that at all. When we talk about a public trust here, I'm talking about a fiercely managed public trust, and we need strong rules, and we're calling for the Great Lakes to be considered a public trust, and we need common laws, and I think we should be saying things like no, you know, tar sands oil or no fracked oil being transported, crack down on those big barges coming in and dumping their ballast where the invasive species are coming in. And so, I mean, believe me, I would have a lot of regulations to protect the Great Lakes if I were the queen of the Great Lakes. So it's not that. When we talk about pricing, we tend to think about it as individual families or small businesses paying. But in fact, the great use of water is raw water. It's only about 9% of all water that's used in residential and small businesses. The big water is agribusiness, it's hydroelectric, it's the mining companies and so on. So my argument is that why are we giving away or subsidizing this raw water for profit-making companies that then turn around and sell it back to us or sell the product that they got out of that water back to us? I think it's time we had a discussion about, it's kind of like charging royalties, you know, a royalty for this water if you're a private company making money from it. We would make a lot more money that way than we're going to ever make from private families to put back into protection of water source and to ensure the fair distribution of water. But I'm not at all talking about a free-for-all. I really want to ensure your listeners that.
Andrew, thank you for that call. And let's go next to Penelope in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Penelope.
Hi. I was hoping that you could speak to virtual water, the water used in the manufacturing process of our disposable goods and our disposable culture, and how we waste water just in as consumers.
Thank you so much, Penelope. I write about this a lot in the book. Most people don't know what it is. In fact, what the United Nations has been using a statistic about how much water we all use on average every year, but the recent studies tell us that if you include what virtual water we use, that's all the water in the food that you eat, the electronics that you use, the clothing that you wear, all the stuff that needed water to create or to produce, then it's about 10 times what we thought the average water footprint was. And we tend to look, if we think, well, I'm going to save water, I'm going to get those low flow shower heads and, you know, the appliances that are better and so on, and I'll turn the water off when I brush my teeth, and that all that's good. But that doesn't really touch the massive amount of water that we use, and that's the water mostly actually in our global food trade. So one of the answers to the water crisis is more local sustainable food production, that if something can be grown closer to home, that's the food product that you should be importing. That we in Canada should not be eating those great big steroid fat strawberries in January, you know, and that we think more carefully about what products and what commodities use water, and how we can promote better use and protection of water by moving to more local sustainable production.
All right, Penelope, thank you for that. And Maude, in our last 35 seconds or so here, you've written about water and a pretty bleak future if nothing changes with our current water practices. What is the most important thing that we need to do and advocate for if we want to avoid the future you describe?
Well, I want people to have hope. The book is actually called, you know, as you know, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. I believe that if we could see water as a public trust, as a common heritage, that we could see that water itself has rights, and that we could move towards water being nature's gift to teach us how to trust one another and treat one another better, that we could actually use water as a vehicle for peace and not war. So I actually come out with a hopeful message, but I think you have to start with the truth, and the truth is we've taken it for granted and we need to stop doing that.
Maude, thank you so much for being with us today.
My entire pleasure, Veronica. Thank you.
That was Maude Barlow, head of the Council of Canadians and founder of the Blue Planet Project. Her new book is called Blue Future, Protecting Water for People and the Planet Forever. She's also chair of Food and Water Watch.